Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we make some predictions for the Premier League season ahead, including our biggest disappointments and the players we think might break out. We open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we've got an anything but football special with your questions. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for another two episodes of Unseen Incidents, and this week we're quite lucky to have you here, Pete, because you're on holiday right now.
I am. It's very, very noble of me to be here.
It is noble of you.
For the greater good, I'm sacrificing. It's also weird. We're doing this in the morning for the first time ever.
Mm.
We're opening season three. Well, I'm calling this season three, episode one. Said there now. It makes the most sense to be. But we're opening season three with a very rare 11:30 a.m. for me, 10:30 a.m. for you, because I'm in France on holiday, like you just said, and I'm very, very sacrificing my holiday to be here. But besides that, I'm happy to be here. And also, I don't do anything before like midday anyway. Mm-hmm. So at worst, I'm missing like an hour of the day that I wouldn't have missed had I not been here. An hour or two. How are you, Patrick?
It is good of you to be here. I mean, I'm okay. I'm on holiday next week, and I'm a bit apprehensive about it because it's like first trip away with both children.
Yeah, where are you going?
We're going to Portugal, and we're going with my in-laws, so with my wife's parents and my sister's in-law, so there will be loads of us there.
You can really like double up on both of them, like you're not having to run zonal.
Exactly. Yeah. But we are, and we're flying out as well with my sister's in-law, so we do actually have like some wiggle room there. But just the idea of like corralling everybody and like potentially like trying to get the baby to sleep, like normally they're quite good about that on the flight, but it's one of those things where like I'll relax once I'm there, but right now it's like a set of problems that I need to solve before
they don't even exist yet, but you're just trying to preemptively solve problems that might happen, might not happen.
That is my problem, Pete.
I've heard traveling with kids is terrible.
Honestly, we've actually been okay with it in the past. We've been quite fortunate. Like, sometimes you get stuck on, like, a 2.5-hour train or something, and your kid's just pissed off, and you've got to entertain them that whole time, and that does suck. But actually, on flights, Coco always used to sleep. Even when we got delayed in Florence by quite a long time, and we had to try and get her to sleep, and I don't know, it just was all a bit disastrous. But it was still, like, it was a bit disastrous timing-wise, but it all still worked out okay, because, like, kids are all right, really. And now we're at the point where, like, if Coco doesn't sleep, it's not a problem. The baby will sleep. It's probably all right, but I'm like, Papa's holiday starts when the kids go down to sleep the first night that we are there.
Yeah.
That's when my holiday begins. But all the time up until that happens is, like, the most stressful day of my life.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to that. I love that for you.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. What's your biggest problem? Like making sure you've got enough ice for your drinks.
I've got ice water. It's weird. I'm having to bring in drinks that I wouldn't usually bring to this podcast because it's the morning. Usually everything's alcoholic or mostly alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And Jess has actually already texted me saying, "Do you want me to bring you a beer at 12?" So you know, obviously everybody else appreciates this without even me saying it. I've got a fresh croissant here in case I get hungry.
Okay,
freshly bought from the bakery. And after we do this evening, we're now going to go to a Michelin star restaurant for dinner. So you know, keeping it accessible as ever. There is one literally just down the road.
Just as well, you know, to like a bit of a palate cleanser after a long day of work.
Yeah.
To be honest, I just ate a pan au chocolat made by Coco. It's nice that my kids have reached the point where they could. I mean, there's less chocolate in it than there should be because she does like to eat quite a bit of it as she does it. But yeah,
and I'm assuming that feedback will be in the TripAdvisor review.
Well, she'll understand my disappointment one way or another. But you know,
three out of five.
Just more chocolate, I'll take it out on her over the next like 15 years until she until she leaves her home.
Yeah, and probably, arguably never comes back.
Yeah, exactly. Should we bounce into it? Because we've got a bit of a predictions episode, but we want to do it in a slightly different way. We are going to talk about who we think will win the Premier League, but then we want to talk about disappointment, breakout players, players who we think might be on a bit of a redemption tour this season after they've gone down in people's estimation. Obviously, we've got the burn book, and then on the other side, we've got a roster of hopefully fun questions in anything but football, because we wanted to make it fun and relatively revision light for Pete, given that he is coming to us from holiday. So thank you to everybody who sent in questions for that. But shall we start with our Premier League winners? Should we talk about our Premier League winners? Do you want to start or shall I?
Well, who have you gone for first off?
I've gone for Manchester City.
Okay, so I've gone for Arsenal.
Okay, that's interesting.
I thought you might go for Arsenal, but also you're always quite down on Arsenal. It feels like you just don't want to get too excited or leave yourself vulnerable to ridicule when it maybe probably doesn't happen, given how good and perpetually victorious City are.
Well, and there's still a couple of days left of the window.
Sure.
So Arsenal, if Arsenal do something in that time, by which I mean bring in a forward who can play wide, then that might change my estimation a bit. But right now, Arsenal have, I'd say, hopefully slightly upgraded the left-back slot, at least in the fact they've got Timber and Calafiori for a place where they had Zinchenko and Kivior last year. They've brought in Marino, which I think is a really good addition. I think Rice-Marino, with Rice as the six and Marino as the left eight, is going to be a lot better than Partey as the six and Rice as the left eight. I think those players are in their more natural roles there, and I think Marino's good. But those aren't huge, like, they aren't huge upgrades to the team, really. They're like minor improvements in fit. And unless Arsenal go and get another forward, I don't really see a reason to like sort of push them over the top here. Like, yes. Why shall I talk about City?
Yeah.
Because, okay, the one big question mark against City, I guess, is that Alvarez is gone. And so if Haaland gets injured, they have a problem that needs to be solved. Not just in the fact that they don't have Alvarez who can play as a centre forward, but in the past they had wingers who could get a ton of shots and kind of function as a striker if needed. So, you know, Mahrez used to get a ton of shots. Sterling used to get a ton of shots. Like, they had Gabriel Jesus, of course, as well. Like, these are guys who can play wide but can play as proper strikers, essentially, or at least play as proper strikers in the sense of getting three shots inside the box in a game. They don't have those kinds of wingers anymore. They have Doku, Grealish, Savio, and Foden. None of whom is really an inside forward in the way that some of those guys used to be. Then in midfield, they've got, you know, Bernardo Silva and De Bruyne. So there isn't an obvious solution if Haaland gets injured. So that is a little bit of a concern. They'd probably have to go to a youth player. However, they were right up there with Arsenal last season in a pretty bad season. And we noticed the numbers were in decline, but I'd be surprised if Pep didn't notice too. And I think Pep will probably try something different this season. And I think it's really interesting that he's brought in Savio and now kind of has the option of the creative type wingers in Foden and Grealish or the real kind of proper winger type wingers in Savio and Doku. That's interesting to me. He's also brought back Gundogan, which is just easy. Gundogan goes straight back in. He knows the role. I think I'd rather have him playing than Nunes. I'd often rather have him playing than Kovacic if I was playing Kovacic alongside Rodri. You know, I want Kovacic to play in that Rodri role when he plays. I don't really want him bursting into the box because he's not good at it. So Gundogan, I think, is a smart pickup as well.
Yeah.
There's a year more development for guys like Doku, for guys like Rico Lewis. And some of the rumoured sales that we thought might happen, for example, Edison going to Saudi, Bernardo Silva finally leaving. These didn't happen. Alvarez is a big one, but he is the only one, and the rest of the team has stayed very, very stable. So I don't think that there's any reason to believe they'll really be that much worse this season, barring a big injury to Haaland. And even if there were a big injury to Haaland, I still think that Pep would be able to cobble something together. I still think they'd be good enough in attack to win most of their games. So yes, they haven't replaced Alvarez appropriately. Yeah. No, they have got one out, one in. But Arsenal haven't upgraded their attack either. And Arsenal's defence was great last season, and it might be just as good this season. But in a way, there's more space on the top end than on the top end of attack than there is on the bottom end of defence. Because it kind of doesn't matter how good your defence is, right? Like, when Arsenal allowed like 28 XG against in the whole of last season.
Yeah.
Well, the defence could get a bit better, but there's only so much better it could get. Like, you're not realistically going to concede, like 20 Chelsea XG 17 in a goals. Season.
Yeah.
Well, even then, that was, like, kind of lucky.
Overperformance, yeah.
Yeah, like, you're not going to... It's relatively unlikely you're going to do that. Whereas at the top end, you probably can add 5 or 10 goals. And Arsenal last season overperformed to get as many goals as they did. So I wanted them to upgrade the attack in order to maintain that level. When they haven't, it makes me think, well, can the attack perform at that same level? I don't. Maybe it can, because Havertz is fully settled and one of my players, I'm going to come back later.
Yeah. But I think that's a big thing with Arsenal, is that they look better now attacking wise than they did at the start of last season, just because Havertz has kind of bored out a role for himself. He's kind of figured out
that's true.
How to become the focal point and how to play within this Arsenal front six. And we've seen in the back half of last season where Arsenal were on fire, and through the Euros he was good as well for Germany, and now again he seems to have hit the ground completely running. Arsenal, I think, are in a better position now than they were last season. And while they haven't added a player, I think you, in the same way that Timber feels like a new signing, to less of a degree, Havertz is an upgrade on himself from last season.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that's enough to make the needle, to move the needle, is kind of neither here nor there. But I don't think Arsenal need to be that much better. I don't think Arsenal need to make that wholesale upgrade, because they've been literally thereabouts for two seasons now. And just based on probability alone, if they keep putting themselves in that position to like accrue title winning worthy point totals, they are going to win one at some point. And I don't believe that it's beyond the realms of possibility for it to be this season. If you look at two seasons ago, they finished 5 points back, and that was with the collapse in the kind of last 8 games where they only won 2 games. Mm-hmm. So for 30 games of that 38 game season, they were a title winning team. I think they led the league for like 250 days of that season, the most of any team in the Premier League history to not win the league. Last season, they finished far stronger. I think 16 of their last 18 games they won, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something insane. And they finished 2 points behind City. So for 68 games out of the, 72 games available, the 76 games available, they've been essentially a title worthy team. So if they keep doing that, there's no reason as to why they can't win the league this season. And also, their total last season, 89 points with a 62 goal difference, was good enough to beat City's tally the year before, where Arsenal collapsed in the running. So like, they are putting together title winning seasons. They're just being on the wrong side of it. And you know, they had the best defense last season. They had the best XG diff per 90 last season. They had the second best attack, which, while it was an overperformance, they scored 5 goals less than City. And they did so with having Bukayo Saka as their top scorer with 16 goals versus Erling Haaland, who had 27 goals and is arguably the most prolific striker in Premier League history. At least he's on that trajectory currently. So, and maybe that's a difference. Maybe the difference is that City just have this prolific number 9. And, you know, I think seven or eight teams had a higher goal scorer than Bukayo Saka. So maybe that is a difference. But also at the same point, like, I think it ultimately is so close. I think it's far closer than people think. And everybody is full of like superlatives for City, and rightly so. They are an incredible team. But Arsenal have been literally like right on their tails for two seasons now, consistently, bar that 8-game collapse in the back end of the season before last. And nobody really takes them as seriously as they perhaps should. And I feel that like over time, this will come out in the wash, and that like they will win one if they keep putting themselves in this position. And they've added, you know, Kaifuri and essentially Timber, like you said. But I think also because they're the challenger, like they're the challenging brand versus City being the market leader. And when you're like the challenger brand, you need to work harder and be more inventive to kind of like break that glass ceiling. City, on the other hand, have won, if they win the league this season, it'll be 5 in a row. They won the treble season before last. This is a team that has done everything and won everything, and a manager that has won everything and seemingly has one foot out the door. For me, there is a real danger of complacency, even just a little bit of complacency entering this City squad, because if City don't win the league this season, do the players in their squad care? Not really, because it'll be one of a drawer full of Premier Leagues, of Premier League titles, of Premier League medals that they won't have. Or the majority of the team was there for the treble winning season. A lot of the team was there for this Centurion season. Oh, yeah, probably half the team was there for Centurion season. Like, they've been there and done it. And even if they become like 5 or 10% complacent, 5 or 10% intensity drops because of that, they're like, oh, we've been here, we've done that. Arsenal are so hungry. They have to be so hungry because the carrot is just perpetually dangling in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they have to be super hungry. And I think that really could be the difference between between Arsenal and City this season. Because realistically speaking, it's like Arsenal and City, then probably a gap, a decent gap, then maybe Liverpool, and then a smaller gap, and then the rest. And that's, you know, whether how far Liverpool are ahead of the chasing pack remains to be seen. But I think it's, for all intents and purposes, it's Arsenal and City, and then the rest. So this kind of basically comes down, in my opinion, to a straight shootout between those two. And if City go a little bit complacent, if their squad's like, oh, well, you know, Pep's probably going to leave at the end of the season or next season, you know, it feels like there's a bit of a wind down in this kind of City era, the Pep City era. Whereas the trust the process Arteta era, this season at least, is now probably in fifth gear. Like, in terms of trajectory, in terms of plans, five-year plans, etc., projections, this season is probably the first season where they've expected, or they will have expected, to be at like full speed. And this and the next three seasons are probably like the height of this process, at least I think in terms of their kind of projection of where they would be when they started it. I think they hit the heights a little bit quicker than they thought they would. And I think this stretch of 2-3 seasons from this season onwards is kind of where they would have expected to be, like, we are now ready to go. And they totally are. And I just feel that, like, Arsenal are still chasing the carrot and still have that hunger. City caught that carrot long ago. And I genuinely think that could just make a difference. Because I think Arsenal are in a better position than they were last season. They've got a stronger defence. They've got more depth in defence. And Havertz has figured out how he plays in this team to very, very good effect. And I think that is enough for, because Arsenal have literally just been there for two seasons, bar the 8-game collapse. I think that could be just enough. Why can't Arsenal win it this season? They've come so close before.
It's totally possible. I'm not saying it's not possible.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, I do think though that like Arsenal. Okay, so one of the paths for Arsenal to win it this season is also that like their players get better, like Martinelli, who again we'll come on to later. Martinelli, 10 goal involvements last season, had double that the season before, could easily like make a leap and not just get back to the previous level, but be better. Havertz, yeah, full season of Havertz is the equivalent of that player getting better. Gabriel Jesus could be fitter. Like, that would be very helpful. And Bukayo Saka is now at the age where a lot of good forwards become superstars, and he's kind of already playing at like a superstar level. If he makes the leap, and after the first two games, I wouldn't be surprised if he did, because the way that Saka makes the leap probably is that he becomes a better goal scorer. And he's already a pretty good one. But like you saw in the Wolves game, he cuts inside, scores a goal. In the Villa game, there are a couple of moments, cuts inside, beats his man, had a shot really well saved by Martinez. Like, if he starts doing that more often, he also got that assist for Havertz, like kind of doing the same thing. Like, if he starts doing that basically all the time and players just can't stop him doing it, like, he can just get better. Because for him to get better and Martinelli to get better and for Saliba to get better, it's all totally possible because of the age they're at. However, relatively little shit happened to Arsenal last season. So when they lost at Newcastle away, that was kind of shit happened. Like, you know, like kind of freak goal. When they lost both times to Villa, that's kind of shit happening. Maybe the West Ham game, but I thought they were pretty bad in that match. Fulham game, I thought they were rubbish. But look, like 4 points off City, 4 points off Liverpool, 6 points off United, like 4 points off Chelsea, 4 points off Spurs. Like, they just didn't lose any of those games last season.
Mm-hmm.
And admittedly, a draw turning to a loss is not that big a deal if you pick up points elsewhere. And they've already beaten Villa away. So that's like 3 points up versus the fixture last year. But some of those results could just go against them because that's what happens. You know, Saka, Rice, Saliba, Odegaard, any of those guys could get an injury. We haven't really had to contend with that. What we have had to contend with is Martinelli having bad fitness, Gabriel Jesus being injured a lot. So it's not like Arsenal haven't had injury problems that they've had to deal with, but those key players have all been fit pretty much the whole time. Well, easily Saka could get injured and miss half the season. That's totally possible. Like Rice could get injured and miss like 15 games. That's suddenly a huge downgrade on your team. So I just think those things, I have less confidence in Arsenal's ability to fade something like that than I have confidence in City's ability. The only one that I think City...
Outside of Haaland.
Outside of Haaland, yeah, that's the only one. But even then, I don't...
Rodri, even with Gundogan,
Yeah, Rodri, I do think would be a problem.
Yeah, Rodri and Haaland are the two kind of absolutely crucial components. I think you can replace De Bruyne in aggregate and it'd be fine. Like, it'll be passable. And they had to do it at the start of last season, didn't they? Yeah, Rodri, even with Gundogan coming back, is a big one, and Haaland is a huge one.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Rodri was obviously missing for that first game of the season against Chelsea. And, like, you don't want to read too much into the first game, but, like, City were the better side, but they didn't look like you couldn't get at them. Like, there were several moments in that game.
Pretty decent.
Yeah, there were several moments in that game where Chelsea did something, and I was like, Chelsea are a ramshackle team with a new manager, like, who will probably look very different 2 months into the season. But because they've got a bunch of players who are good, they were able to create a lot. They were able to get loads of touches in the box. They were able to play through the press reasonably well. Like, there were actually lots and lots of positives in that game, I thought, for Chelsea. If City had had, like, Liverpool in the first game of the season, I would not have been surprised to see them lose that match. Because Liverpool have looked incredible so far. Yeah, there are kind of question marks there about, like, those two players. But at the same time, I've seen City deal with big absences before, and I haven't really seen Arsenal do that much. So that's why it's a question mark. It doesn't mean that, like, Rice gets injured and Arsenal lose like 10 games on the bounce while he's away. It just means that Arsenal kind of have to figure it out. And also, like, right now, you know, their next couple of away games, they've got Spurs away, they've got City away. You lose a couple of those and you're...
Chelsea actually had a higher XG than City in that game.
They did, but at the same time, you know, City were in the lead, like,
sure,
who knows.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, I don't know. With City, I just think they probably find a way to get it done. Gundogan is just a player they know who fills a need. And I like Savio. I think Doku has a lot more to come from him. They got basically nothing out of Grealish last season, which was Pep's decision. Pep could have played him more.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like Grealish was injured and they were suffering. It was like they chose to...
Is that going to change this season, though? With the players they brought in as well, and with Doku wanting to go off that left? I suppose he's more of a top player, but... Yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, you've got more games this season, and squad depth is not just about, like, who you want to play, but who you have to play if it goes down the list. Like, Arsenal... If Martinelli got injured, they play Trossard. But if Trossard also got injured, then what do they do? You know?
Yeah.
Like, you, after a couple of injuries, like, what are you left with? To me, that's the question. And it's nice for City that at least if Doku gets injured, oh, what do we play? We play Jack Grealish, who we paid £100 million pounds for.
Yeah.
Like, it's not terrible. So, I wouldn't be surprised to see Arsenal win the league. Liverpool look amazing so far and dangerous, but I'd still be slightly surprised to see them do it because I think Klopp did an amazing job last season and they haven't meaningfully strengthened.
No.
If they'd gone out and got like that DM...
And they still
then
need a DM.
Like,
even with Bajicic, like, they still need a DM. He's a 19-year-old kid. He barely played last season because he was injured. They've got a 32-year-old with Toro Rendo. Like, that is it.
Yeah. And the story for them winning... Like, people are getting very excited about them. But what is the story that you're telling for Liverpool to win the league? It's Arne Slot is a better manager of this squad than Jurgen Klopp. Because... Not only have they not, like, addressed a significant area of need, they have Salah, who is a year older. As amazing as he looks, he is a year older. Van Dijk, year older. Like, those are problematic positions, and they're extremely reliant on those guys. Even Robertson is, like, 30-ish. Yeah. Like, there are all these issues that you do have to deal with, and I think Klopp managed to deal with them really, really well last season. How does Slot manage it if some of these guys get injured? I don't think he can do it to the same extent Klopp did because Klopp was a special coach.
Also, he built that team. You know, he was like the godfather to that era of Liverpool football. Like, Slot does not have that weight behind him.
It's to me, it's just ridiculous for like Liverpool fans to kind of think, well, we will improve on how we played last season without having improved the squad, because yeah, it does just assume that like Slot is better, and Slot wasn't even Liverpool's first choice to replace Klopp. So I think that they'll be good this season. I think they'll be a problem. I think they'll beat some big teams.
I think they're third or fourth. Like they'll finish third or fourth.
I think they'll finish third, but like
I think probably yes.
But that's but it wouldn't be, again, it wouldn't be surprising if Salah missed a chunk of the season. Salah has been incredibly injury resistant his whole career, but he is now edging towards his mid-30s. Like, it wouldn't be surprising to see Van Dijk miss a stretch of the season. He was incredible last year, but the year before he had a difficult one. And again, you're now 33, I think. It's an age where you expect to miss some games or expect to see your output go down. So I go for Man City just because I still think if you're picking a team, Man City are the team to pick.
I just do not wish to pick Man City.
No, fair enough. And I think, you know, I think Arsenal, you're right. If Arsenal keep being in the hunt for these titles, they'll get one of them.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe it's just the fact that the first couple of games of the season, Arsenal also haven't looked particularly good, but Villa away, like whatever.
But also, City usually start pretty hot. Like Haaland always starts really, really hot. In the front end of seasons, and then slows a little bit in the kind of middle. And then City, at least in a couple of seasons across the last handful, have taken a real dip of points in the middle of seasons. So I think everything has kind of gone, everything has played out similar to how it generally plays out or has played out across most of the most recent seasons. Sure.
I think, look, I might change my mind. Like, if City bring in another forward to replace Alvarez before the deadline, then I'll be like very, very confident in City. But if they don't, and Arsenal go and get, you know, they're rumored to be interested, obviously, in Nico Williams, but they're rumored to be interested in a loan for Sterling, a loan for Kingsley Coman. Like, if Arsenal go and do something like that, or Ademola Lookman, you know, like all these guys they're linked with. If Arsenal went and did one of those before the deadline, then I would say that's quite interesting. That does slightly change my perception. But you're right. I think it's more neck and neck than people realise. Like, when you look at, say, the BBC pundit predictions, like 5 or 6 of them have picked Arsenal to win the league and like 20 have picked City.
Yeah.
And it probably is more even than that. Like, if you played the league 100 times, City might win 55 and Arsenal might win 35 and the others go to somebody else.
Underlying stats alone, Arsenal were the better team last year. Sure. On XG diff per 90, I think. I can't remember the expected points per 90 or expected points, but Arsenal were the better team last season. I think it was really close to the season before. Well, especially if you take out the... It's hard to eliminate 8 games of a 38-game season for my argument's sake. But for 68 games, they've been arguably the better team, underlying stats-wise, across the last 2 seasons.
Yeah, they were quite significantly better last season. Like, City were closer to Liverpool in third. Liverpool were at plus 1.11 expected goals per 90. City were at plus 1.18 and Arsenal were at plus 1.27, which is kind of crazy. And the previous season, City were definitely clear, I don't remember how much, by quite a lot.
I can't remember how significant that horrific run of form at the back end
affected that. Arsenal started quite badly and ended quite badly that season. Yeah. No, they ended badly that season. So I think it made quite a big difference because Newcastle overhauled them at the end. But even still, I think it would have been a pretty sizable margin.
Taking out that like catastrophic collapse, like Arsenal have literally been at least as good or right there, if not better than City. So like this is going to happen at some point if they can maintain that across full seasons.
Sure. All right. Well, shall we move on to our disappointment?
Yes.
We said this could be a club or a player. I've gone for a club.
I've also gone for a club.
Do you want to give me your name?
I've gone for Aston Villa.
I've also gone for Aston Villa. But I was on Zach's show recently and I put them in my top four for the season. That was mostly because they asked me. I wasn't prepared.
Okay.
And also I was just like, let's provoke some debate here. I was like, I prefer Spurs, I prefer Newcastle, I kind of prefer Chelsea, but I don't think there is a nailed on, like, this is the fourth place team. I would love it to be Brighton, you know, or something. But I was just like, I just said kind of Villa, I was like, whatever. To be honest with you, as soon as I got off it, I was like, why did I say that? Like, I do expect them to be worse,
yeah,
at least in their finish this season. Yeah. But I think that people are high on them, right? Because like they came fourth last year. They've had a huge summer. Like, actually, in net terms, they've only spent just over 30 mil. But in gross terms, they've spent 176 yeah. mil. So they have actually spent an awful lot of money.
But I don't feel a lot of those have actually moved the needle that significantly. I think two of them do. I think Amadou Onana and Maatsen are the two that move the needle. I think Ross
Barkley... They're my favourite signings they've made.
Ross Barkley is smart based on the price, and like, he had a good season last season for what he is. Like, that is just... Yeah, it's fine. And then the rest are kind of like squad filler young players that... will be useful, and it's definitely because it's going to be a tougher season. Like, even though they went the kind of quite far in the Conference League last year, they're not playing Champions League football, which is going to be more intense. It's going to be more taxing. It's going to be a long season. Like, I think beefing out your squad is a smart move, and I don't think their departures are that significant. Diaby kind of was peripheral. Like, at the end, like, he didn't really fit in that team. Who was the other one who went? I forgot the name. You did a profile on them. They went to Juventus.
Who left? Douglas Luiz.
Yeah, yeah. Again, your whole point was that it was not actually that much. He was holding Villa back before he left. So I don't think their departures are that significant. And I think they got good money for them as well. But Amadou Onana and Maatsen, I think, are the two that move the needle. The rest are kind of fine. They're just depth.
Yeah. And I think that they're kind of only okay depth as well.
Yeah.
Like... basically, last season, Moussa Diaby ended up being kind of depth because he missed quite a lot of the season. And, like, you know, Bailey was, like, really, really good. But Philogene, like, I don't really... like, he's okay. He does quite a lot of interesting stuff in terms of ball progression. But, like, 0.4 expected goals and assists per 90 in the championship doesn't, like, scream superstar. Morgan Rodgers looked phenomenal against Arsenal, and he might be great, but him being great in his first full Premier League season, you know, doesn't look like 15 to 20 goal involvements.
Absolutely
which
not.
Is
that would be
and they did get like 12, I think, out of DRB. So that is a difference there. But really, my issue with them is, like, last year their expected goals and expected goal against were basically even. They conceded a lot of goals. They allowed 61 goals from 60 XG. But they scored 76 from 63 XG. So XG thinks they should have had a +3 goal difference, and they ended up with +15. Their goal difference was fifth best, but their expected goal difference was seventh. And more importantly, they had two players who put up career best seasons.
Yeah.
So Leon Bailey and Ollie Watkins were both at 0.7 expected goals and assists per 90 each, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, they both overperformed. Watkins got 32 goal involvements from 24 XG. Bailey got 19 from 15.5. So these two guys were not only having the best seasons of their career, but they were getting quote unquote lucky on top of that. They were running hot on top of that. So for them to get top four, they had to have these players have career best seasons, and they still needed a bit of luck.
Yeah.
And a bigger issue there is, like, I think those guys might be good attackers and the attack might still be good this season, you know, because, like, it's a bit deeper, but they kind of needed to fix the defense more. Like, the defense is where all the difference is there. And I like Onana. Onana helps. Onana's a better defensive presence than Douglas Luiz, but I don't think he's going to fix it by himself. I think they need to do something else tactically, like whether it's a double pivot of, like, Kamara and Onana, and then they just allow the front four to be, like, very, very attacking. But they need to press more effectively. They need to defend more effectively in midfield. And I don't really know if Emery's going to do that. Like, I don't know if Emery can play defensively, but I don't think he's a particularly good defensive coach, if that makes sense. He sometimes is conservative. I guess I just think, like getting rid of Diaby, I think, was good. Like, I like Diaby.
It was smart.
But they paid crazy money for him. Yeah, they paid crazy money for him. Output wasn't great, injuries not great, and they basically got rid of him for what they paid. Perfect. Yeah. That's fine. But then also there are just some missed tricks this summer. Like, I think Baraneche coming in from Juve as part of the Douglas Luiz deal is, like, fine.
Mm-hmm.
They also brought in Iling Jr., but now Iling Jr. has gone straight back out on loan. He's gone out to Bologna, and Bologna are a Champions League team and think that they can get some use out of him. It's weird to me that Aston Villa don't think they can.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like, and even then with the defense, you know, like Mattsson, I like Mattsson, but Mattsson's not a defensive fullback. He's a little guy who's an amazing passer and a good progressor. The right back replacement for Matty Cash they supposedly wanted.
He's in denial as well, isn't he?
Yeah, and they brought on against Arsenal Costa Nedeljkovic, who is 18.
Yeah.
And like, maybe he's great, but like, probably not.
We're going to find out.
You know, or maybe they're just like, right, okay, we're going to play like one of the centre backs in the right back slot. We're going to do that. Like, there are lots of ways that they could try and improve this, but I'm not convinced that they will be able to do that while maintaining such a crazy attacking output.
Yeah.
And even if you just saw Watkins and Bailey have exactly the same seasons, but get the same, but match their XG, like, then you'd still be down like 11 goals on last season. And that's even before you get into replacing Diaby with Rodgers or Philogene, which I think is also going to be a downgrade.
For me, the biggest issue is the over-reliance on Ollie Watkins. Like, it's hard to not rely on him when he had such a stratospheric season as he did last season. But they got really, really lucky with him last season, both in terms of his goal involvements and also his availability. So there's like 3,400 minutes available in a Premier League season. Ollie Watkins played 3,200 of them last season. Mm. So he played about 94% of the available Premier League minutes last season and started 37 of the 38 games. Like, he was there the whole time as a number nine, playing basically every minute. And like you said, he was also directly involved in 32 goals of Villa's 76. So he scored or assisted 42% of Villa's entire Premier League goal tally last season. So if he suffers an injury, or even just a dip in form, like, that's a significant loss on last season's output, which they relied on to get to fourth.
Yeah.
And he surely is. Like, he's surely likely to suffer some form of dip. Like, if you look at the three seasons before last season, so his first three seasons at Villa, his average goal involvements were 18 per season. Mm-hmm. And so he almost doubled that last season. And I also think he's kind of more likely to get injured or fatigued because he's played a lot of football over the last season or so. Like, Villa made the Conference League semi-finals. They played 12 games in the Conference League. Watkins played in 10 of them. He also went to the Euros, where England played the maximum amount of games available. And even though his on-pitch minutes were limited, he was still training. Like, he was still training at a high intensity. He had a full Euros training camp thing and has basically rolled into the new season with, I imagine, what, 3 weeks holiday? Like, he missed pre-season, but like, basically, he's played football fairly non-stop for a full season, and now we'll go into another season where he now has Champions League football, which will be against much better opposition, which who have deeper squads and will be played at a higher intensity. And then they'll probably, based on the draw, end up in the Europa League knockouts and have more games to contend with. And how crucial Watkins was to Villa last season, essentially they need him to do that exactly the same again. And I just do not think that
that's a really good point.
Both in terms of like physical state, like stature, like his fitness, his fatigue, and in terms of just how insane his output was. I just do not think that is, you can sensibly rely on that. If it happens, amazing. Like, that would be incredible for him to do two seasons back to back like that. I just don't see it happening in the same, I don't see him being as potent as he was last year. And also add to that, like, Villa don't look great. Like, they didn't look good in pre-season. They lost all three of their games in America, and I think they conceded 7 goals and scored 1. Now, granted, they were without Martinez, Konsa, and Watkins, but like, it's not as if this downward trend happened overnight, and it's not as if this downward trend happened just in pre-season. If you look at the league last season, from January 1st to the end of the season, so January 1st to like May, Villa had the 5th lowest expected points tally in the league. So, like, Villa have been out over their skis for a bit. Like, they have been out over their skis for a minute. They were 15th expected points tally in the league in the back half of last season. And this, you know, when you're a team that plays like that and kind of rides their luck a bit, that over time, you know, gravity pulls you back down to earth. Over a long enough sample size, that will generally even out just probability-wise. And I think that's what we're kind of starting to see. And yeah, like we said earlier, like, they brought in a lot of players, but Onana is a needle mover. Mattsson is a needle mover. Mm-hmm. Outside that, it's very average squad fillers, which they'll need, but does it make them better than they were last season? Especially if Watkins takes a little dip. Mm. I don't see it. And then
that's a good point.
Came to was, I think the biggest part of this section, or at least putting them down, us both putting them down as disappointments, is what is defined as a good season and what is defined as a disappointing season, because I think there's a really, really thin line between Villa having a pretty respectable, a good season, and having, shit, that was actually quite a disappointing season. I think there's really, I think it turned disappointing quite quickly.
If they finish like fifth and got out of their Champions League group, I think that's a really good season.
Yeah. But if they finish sixth, I think that's pretty good. I think sixth is a pretty good season given some of the
teams. And they could
easily
finish seventh or eighth and like go out in the group stage. Or they could have a really good run. Like, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, we have talked about, obviously, about Emery as a cup manager. Like, they could easily have a great run in the Champions League, but that probably comes at the expense of a good league campaign. That probably then is like, okay, maybe you're eighth, maybe you're ninth, who knows?
It's really, really common for them, for teams who have overperformed the season before and gotten Champions League football, to have a bit of a hangover from that season. Look at Newcastle last season. Like, I think it's so possible. I think it's actually most likely. I think the most likely finish is probably seventh, maybe eighth. And I think seventh is on the cusp of disappointing, and it depends what you do in the cup competitions as to whether it's a okay season or it's a bit of a step back. I think eighth is a disappointing season, and ninth and below is very disappointing. But I think part of their business this summer as well, a caveat to this, is that I think this season might perhaps be a step back, but it's a step back to then position themselves better to take a step forward in the seasons to come.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that is where, I think that's important to remember, and that it might be a bit harsh to say that this season in isolation, I think, will be disappointing. I think this season, retrospectively looking back in a couple of seasons' time, might be, you know, like the necessary step back to move forward. But in isolation, I think they will be disappointing this season.
Yeah, in a couple of years' time, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, Matson, Onana, Jacob Ramsey, and one of Rodgers and Philogene, like, if all those guys are really good. I mean, they still would have probably taken a step back because they'll still need to, because then they'll be at the point that they need to, like, replace Watkins. But it's totally possible. Oh, but Duran might be good. You know, there's a possibility that in 2 or 3 years' time, they're in a really good position. And Onana and Matson are absolutely the signings you try and make in this spot. But yeah, the idea that you're just like, seem like, for example, Arsenal last year putting up more points while going from not being a Champions League side to a Champions League side, that's quite unusual. It was surprising to me. You know, like, people might remember that at the beginning of that season, certainly I predicted that I thought Arsenal would take a little step back. And the fact they ended up with more points, a decent run in the Champions League,
and probably should have gone further.
Significantly improved underlying numbers. Like, that's quite unusual. And Arsenal are better set up for it because they're just richer than other clubs. And also because they've got young players who are getting better. So I'm optimistic about Villa's long-term future, but this season I expect to be... I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of the season some Villa fans are like, oh, I thought we'd challenge for third and, like, you know, have a really good run in the Champions League. And it's like, no, you made the round of 16 in the Champions League and you finished seventh, maybe. Should we go on to breakout star of the season? Who have you got for breakout star of the season?
So for breakout star of the season, I have Amad Diallo.
Oh my God. Okay.
Well, are you not sold on Amad?
He's all right.
So I wasn't sold on him when he first arrived in 2001. Like, he seemed wasteful and pretty lightweight in the ball, but he was 18. And
sure.
I didn't know, but he actually only had less than 45 minutes experience in a top five European league when we signed him.
Yeah, which is why it's hilarious that you spent so much money on him.
But yeah,
he should be in. I think a lot of people now talk about him kind of assuming he's an academy player. They're like, look at this kid. No, he's really promising. Yeah. And you're like, yeah, because you spent a load of money on him. You spent like eight figures on him.
So yeah, it was insane. He obviously got farmed out to Rangers and Sunderland on loan. Rangers wasn't overly successful, but Sunderland, he had a great season. But the fact, like, perpetual loanees, second, third, fourth season loanees, more often than not tend to end up getting, like, moved on eventually rather than breaking into the first team. But I think Amad could be one of the exceptions to the rule. So he obviously had a fantastic season with Sunderland 2 seasons ago. He won their Young Player of the Year, Championships, Fans Player of the Year, 16 goal involvements in 29-90s. He had a great season. He came back to United with good momentum and looked like he was potentially going to be in, like, a selection rotation. Then tore his meniscus in pre-season and was out until Christmas. After that, he kind of played his way back into the team, got 400 Premier League minutes across the back half of last season. Also scored the, like, 120th minute winner in the FA Cup quarterfinal against Liverpool, which felt like a really pivotal moment in his career. Also, like, fucking hilarious move that he took a shirt off to celebrate and got a red card because he was ready on a yellow.
That's great.
Big Dick Energy move. Love it. But like that felt like a real pivotal moment in his career, just in terms of like the eyes on him. And it feels like the tides are turning with Ahmad. It feels like he's now set up to have a proper breakout season in the Premier League. He's 22 years old. He's just turned 22. Good age. And he's got genuine league experience now in a decent league. Like I think he played 2,600 minutes in the Sunderland campaign in a good season, and he was like their best player or one of their best players. He's an exciting prospect to like fill a hole that has kind of not been properly filled since Nani in the early 2010s. I suppose like Antonio Valencia was at the right wing for United and then got moved back to right back. And then after that, you've got like your Sanchez's, your Di Maria's, your Depay's. Like it's been your Sancho's, your Anthony's. Like it's been a fairly unsuccessful hole that has been filled across the last 10 years. He also seems to have found favour with Ten Hag, at least a lot more so than his direct competitors in Sancho and Anthony. He started all of the three games so far this season, so two games in the Premier League and the Community Shield. He also started the last three games of the Premier League season last year, and he started every Premier League game under Ten Hag since his first start in Premier League under Ten Hag, which was three games before. I think it was the Arsenal game in May, early May. So he seems to have found at least selection favour. He's getting his chances now, and he's been pretty decent when he's done it. He also featured heavily in pre-season. He was our top scorer, three goal involvements of four games that he was available for. And also, like, Anthony continues to look shite. Sancho seems to have a foot out the door perpetually. And it seems like it's set up for Ahmad to actually really stake a good claim to be like, I am Manchester United's right-wing option. Now, one of the issues with that is that on the left, you have Garnacho and Rashford, both of whom are better than Ahmad.
Yeah.
And only
and
one can play,
play on the right.
Yeah, that's the thing. Only one can play left. So what happens when the other one's dropped? Like that, do they then become an option and competing for the right wing spot? If that is true, then it's a decision that Ten Hag will need to make. Do we play Ahmad there, or do we play the non-selected left wing option? And I think that will be a big factor in his minutes this season. But I do think he's going to play quite a lot this season. And I think in terms of individual quality, like he's raw and undefined, but he's shown like good potential. And he is still only 20, he's just turned 22, like he is still young. You know, last season, no United player with more than 100 minutes attempted more dribbles per 90 than his 5.1. He also turned a successful carry into a shot or chance created 1.6 times per 90, which was the second highest in United squad. The only person higher than that was Garnacho, and he was like way up at 2.6, which is a very, very good sign of like how good United's wide young players are coming through, how creative they are and how just like direct they are. So I think it's quite exciting time for United to kind of watch these young players develop. But like the caveat to that is that, yeah, okay, it's 400 minutes. It's a very, very small sample size. But he has had a very, very good season underneath his loan spell at Sunderland. And that paired with last season, I think is enough to think that this guy has something. Like this guy, he scored against Brighton at the weekend. Like this guy has something to give. And until this season, I suppose he was injured most of last season, but until kind of the back end of last season, it felt like he was at best a squad player that might get farmed out when he comes back from Sunderland. He might get farmed out when he came back from injury. And now it kind of feels like he's actually got himself up to speed and is good enough to at least feature as one of like the first rotation options if Garnacho plays on the right. Like he will be the next guy in line. And I think he's set up for a good season. I think he's set up for a breakout season. And I think given the opportunities, because he's also been feeding off scraps. He was given some opportunities at the back end of last season and he performed well. And he performed well in big moments. He was given good chances in preseason. He performed, in terms of goal involvement, the best in the United's team. He's also already got off the mark this season in the two games that he started. So, the Premier League games that he started. So I think everything's shown that this guy has the ability to play at this level. And I think that he can only get better because he's 22. He's just turned 22. I think this will be a breakout season for him. How high his ceiling is, I'm unsure. But I think this will be a breakout season for him.
Yeah, I think the thing is, if Garnacho was like a 25-year-old who was like a regular player and had reliably split his time between left and right, then I'd be a bit more worried. But because he's not that, because he is a left winger, really. And because he also is a young player who kind of needs some time off the pitch, I think Diallo is going to get a lot of time there. And kind of as you've said, like, I think as because of where Ten Hag is in his United career, at this stage, he's going to be like, I just need people who are going to do what I tell them to do. Like, yeah. I can't run any risks with guys like going off piece. Like the fact this season that he's kind of started with this like 4-4-2 basically with like Mount and Fernandez like playing higher up, like seems to be like, we need to balance this team somehow. And I need to have people who will obey my tactical instruction and perform functions that I need of them rather than like, well, this guy's a reliable player for them and this guy's been here for a long time, blah blah blah. With Diallo, his goal and assist output I'm not sure about. Like he got those 16 goals in the championship from about 10 expected goals. That's a bit concerning, but he was 20. He can obviously improve. What he has always had is like very good defensive intensity and he's a very reliable passer. And that means already that he can do the couple of things that Antony was capable of doing.
Yeah.
Plus, I just think, you know, we've said it before, but like a bit of directness on the wing, a bit of fearlessness,
yeah,
is better than timidity. Like, I mean, I don't want to just like sound like kind of Rio Ferdinand or something, just saying like, yeah, take people on, like have a go. But like sometimes United do need somebody to take people on and have a go. You know, like Antony, I think quite early on in his United career, realised that he just couldn't run past Premier League defenders. And so the only thing he would really do is come inside and pass or try and get free for that shot at the corner of the box. And when he couldn't do it, he was like, I can't do anything.
Left. I'm just going to spin.
Whereas at least if you're quick and a little bit tricky. Yeah, exactly. The one spin. At least if Diallo's like quite quick and a bit tricky, like he'll get past some people and that might be enough. Like,
And he's shown that he is getting past people and something is coming at the end of that. Like,
sure.
More so than anybody Borgonacho.
Well, I think that'll be true even just because of like the gravity
just
of
volume as well.
United's attack. Like, for a long time now, people have basically felt like you can ignore that side of United.
Like, it's so harsh, but it's so true.
Yeah, because you don't have attacking fullbacks and you don't have a good right winger.
It was fucking Wan-Bissaka and Antony.
And still, you know, look, if I was lining up against United, I'd be like, we've got to deal with Bruno, we've got to deal with Garnacho and Hoyland or whoever it is up front like that. That's going to be an issue. Like, or Rashford if he's playing off the left. But like, I'm not scared of the guy playing right wing. Well, that might bode well for Diallo because if United can switch the ball to him quickly or if
give
other teams don't kind of deal with him, especially with Mazraoui there as well, who will actually get up on the outside of him, that's going to help him too. So that whole side should be much more functional with Diallo Mazraoui than it was with like Wan-Bissaka or Dalot plus Antony. So I think it's quite a good candidate. There's an interesting like bunch of events happening there that could result in a good season for him. My guy is João Pedro. In all the excitement about Brighton signings, it's easy to forget about guys who are already there. But João Pedro kind of looks like he's putting it all together now. He's about to turn 23. And last year, he got 8 non-penalty goal involvements, but from 12 expected goal involvements, about 0.5 per 90. So that's like now at the point where you say, okay, this is like a good player, 22 years old with those numbers. That's very interesting stuff. And that's not all that he's good at. He's exceptional in loads of ways. So he gets 3 shots a game and 8 touches in the box, both of which are like, that's crazy. 8 touches in the box and 3 shots for a non-striker is bananas. But he's also getting 9 progressive receptions, 2 passes into the penalty area and 2 carries into the penalty area, which is the stuff you'd expect to see from a very good winger. He's also over 80% pass accuracy. He's also got 2 defensive actions a game. Again, these are above average for his position. He gets fouled constantly 2.6 times a game. That's 10th in the league. So you're constantly winning free kicks. Teams are constantly chopping you down. Generally speaking, you're probably a bit more skillful than the guys you're up against. And again, this is now the season. 23 years old is often when players make the leap from good to great or from great to amazing. Like, it's when that happens. And he is already very good.
Yeah.
The one concern is that Hertzler could prefer other people because obviously they've got Minte, they've got Gruder, they've got Mitoma, they've got Ferguson, they've got Rutter. But like, they've got Enciso.
Versatile though. Like, it's not he's nailed down to one position, and it's like if he's not selected for that position, then he's on the bench. I think there's
none of those guys are really tens. Like, yeah. Barring Enciso, who could play there, I guess. Like, none of those guys are 10. And Pedro started as a 10 against Man United the other day. And I suspect that Hertzler will love him. Because I thought in that game, I was like, Joao Pedro needs to come off. He looks exhausted. Like, that game was so end-to-end. And about 65, 70 minutes, I was looking at him as Brighton dropped off, you know, when United got the ball back.
Yeah.
And it was pretty end-to-end at that stage. And I was like, this guy's basically playing as an 8 now. He's defending a lot. Mm-hmm. He's also carrying the ball a lot. He's running forward to join every attack. He looks gassed. And they made a triple substitution and they left Pedro on. And I was like, wow, that's bold.
Ballsy.
And he got the winner.
Yeah.
But the fact that Hertzler didn't want to take him off, I thought was fascinating. He took off Minter and Mitoma and he left on Joao Pedro.
Telling. Yeah.
I was like, that's interesting. Like, he's like, this is my guy. This is the guy who stays on. This is
the integral cog in the system. Yeah.
And I think an interesting thing to keep an eye on with Brighton is that this window, they have spent 200 million net.
Have
After
they?
Sales, they've spent 200 million euros. Yeah.
They have spent, that's so insane.
They spent 30 on Gruder, 30 on Minter, like 25, 30 on Vifa. Like, they spent £40 million on Ruta. Like, they've made a bunch. So Ferdy Kaliolu has just arrived. Matt O'Reilly has just arrived.
I guess because they're all like 30, £40 million deals. Like, they just kind of fly under the radar. But there's so many
of
them.
They stack up. Like, they've just added like guys on guys on guys on guys on guys. Like, they've got so many players that they've added this summer. Well, that makes me think that next summer, they're probably expecting to sell one or two.
Yeah.
If Ferguson has a big season, it would make sense for Ferguson to go if Ruta's there. Mitoma is 27 now. So I think if somebody came in big for Mitoma, they'd be quite happy. Because as good as he is, I think currently he's the best of these players.
Yeah, but his ceiling's probably the lowest.
And he's the oldest. Yeah, because he's the oldest.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but like if Arsenal, you know, if Chelsea had come in for Mitoma instead of Pedro Neto, if Arsenal said, right, we need a winger, let's go and get Mitoma now. Like, Brighton would drive a hard bargain, but I think they'd be like, that's absolutely fine. Like, we've already replaced this player ahead of time. Joao Pedro, nobody's really talking about him as a guy who could move on from there. But he looks big club ready. He is playing big club football, like in every regard. And he's still at an age where you would expect him to get better than this. In 2 years' time, he might be genuinely fantastic. So I wouldn't be surprised if next summer we're like, oh, somebody's coming in for Joao Pedro for like 70 mil because he's turned into one of the best all-round attackers in the league. Like, that's completely possible to me. He's a very interesting player. And Brighton also are just going to be super, super fun to watch. Like, I know we go on about Brighton a lot, but like, Minter has played 1.5 games and has 10 carries into the penalty area. Like, he is absolutely relentless. And his decision-making against United was atrocious. And he still carried the ball into the penalty area 7 times.
Yeah, he's like, so it just doesn't matter. Carries per 90 then. Into the
it just doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, you're like, you can make bad decisions like 60% of the time. But if you beat your man like this often, you get into the box this often, eventually you're going to create goals. Just it's not possible that you won't.
It's a luxury you have to be wasteful if you're that involved in attacking play. Just volume alone.
So I'm really optimistic about them. You know, there's a Dingra there as well. Like, there's just loads and loads of players like who are all really good. Like, you could basically mix and match any of those forwards and get a pretty fun front line. So, but Pedro is somebody who I would probably last season I would have watched Mitoma if I was like turning up to watch a Brighton game. And this season, you know, I still think, oh, I want to watch Minter. But I will now be watching Pedro with greater interest because slowly over last season, he grabbed my attention. And I think it could be a big year from him. So shall we go on to Redemption Tour? This is our last
back
one.
From the dead.
Back from the dead. So this is a player who has been written off or like underrated after last season and now who we think is primed to have a good campaign. Do you want to start or should I?
Yeah, so my one's quick. I'm not going to go into too much detail because we actually covered this player, I think, on the last episode. I think you did a very good profile on him. And my player is Emile Smith-Rowe.
Okay.
And I think this is an obvious choice for Back in the Day because he's been dead for a while now, a couple of seasons. But I think I really rated the signing. I think you put it in as your favourite signing. I think that was a section that you did. So if you want to listen to something a little bit more in depth, Patrick did a very good one on the last episode, so go check that out. But I think this is smart from Fulham for me, and I think it's smart for Smith-Rowe as well. You know, I think this is a great opportunity for him to reignite what is like a stuttering career. And he's a player that was like formerly an incredibly bright young prospect. I think Marco Silva will use him a lot this season. He's tactically versatile. He can play as a cam. He can play as a left eight. He can even play wide on the left in certain systems. He presents like a lot of options for Marco Silva to use across the season. Obviously, he's been largely absent for two seasons, which is a huge concern. But going back to his like last proper season, 21-22, he was great. Like for what he was, he was very, very good. He played 2,000 minutes in the league, got 12 goal involvements, albeit from like eight expected goal involvements. But what I found interesting was his creation numbers and where they were, and I suppose like the potency of them. So in that season, a third of his open play chances created came from that kind of central outside the box area. Like if you were to draw like a little box right in the middle of the half, just outside the center of the penalty box, a third of his chances were created from there. The kind of like what you would expect from a traditional 10. But in that season, only 6% of his touches came in that area. So the frequency at which he was creating was far greater, given the fact that he wasn't actually getting a huge amount of ball there. I think that's really, really interesting if he's going to be playing large roles as a 10 in this film system, which, as we've seen, is where he started and kind of where he's operated in the first two games. In that season with Arsenal, I think he got like a third of his touches in the left flank. So he was kind of pulling out left a lot more, which shows his versatility in attacking and build up. And he's kind of very good at kind of moving into little pockets and picking up the ball there. But when he got into that outside the box number 10 position with the ball in that season for Arsenal, a third of his chances came from that, despite being like, what, 1/20th, just over 1/20th of his actual touches for the whole season coming there. And I think that's really, really interesting because it shows he can be an incredibly dangerous and creative player from central, like a calm role, and doesn't need a huge amount of touches to do that. Doesn't need a huge amount of ball to do that. He doesn't need to be a super high usage player there. He can turn a lot of half opportunities or games where he's not really involved or not getting a huge amount of ball, he can still damage teams. He can still create chances. He can still be dangerous on the ball. And I think that'll be really, really good for Fulham going forward. Because again, we've said that we don't think they're going to have a great season. I think there's going to be a lot of games where they don't have a ton of ball. I think there's going to be a lot of games where they're struggling to create chances or having very, very few opportunities to create chances. Emile Smith-Rowe in that Arsenal season has shown that he can do that with kind of feeding off scraps in that place, that in that area of the pitch he's probably going to play. Obviously, the caveat is that his injury record is not good. But,
not good.
You know, the big caveat is if he can stay fit. I think he'll be really useful this season. I think the redemption, the Emile Smith-Rowe redemption tour, if it gets up to speed, I think it'll be a fantastic story. I kind of want him to do well as well. Like, I have no animosity towards him. I think he's weirdly like a player that I, for no reason, favour. I think this season has been slow. He obviously scored against, it's been two games, so it's hard to look into it too much, but he scored, I think it was last week, but he hasn't really found his kind of creative numbers yet. I think FBref have recorded just one shot creating action from his first two games. So he hasn't really found that part of his game yet, but that's kind of to be expected. He's in a new team, in a new system, hasn't played really for 2 years almost, at least not in Premier League. I think it'll take a little bit of time to get up to speed. He's also probably only good for like 60 minutes. Like, you're kind of wrapping him in cotton wool at the minute, trying to get him back up to like match fitness. But I think he will get there, provided you say, this is the thing, if he can stay fit, he will play a lot of minutes. I think he'll be a focal point for like the back end of Fulham's build up. I think the ball will come into him and he will create from there. And yeah, I think it's a really smart signing. And I think that finally this player who was hugely tipped as a youngster might finally get to some heights. Not the heights that people maybe once thought he was capable of, but still pretty very, very respectable Premier League attacking midfielder heights.
Yeah. And I think as well, you know, if he's in the middle there, he's going to have like Adama Traore on one side, who is like at least an interesting, like, he's a problem player that Smith Rowe can find.
Yeah.
And then if they just have Muniz up front for the whole season, I think that's a really big upgrade for Fulham. A really big upgrade. And that could, and he's quite good. He's strong. He can hold the ball up. For Smith Rowe to be the second runner around him, I think starts to create an interesting problem for other teams. Plus, he's got a good relationship with Iwobi. In fact, you've already seen that. Like, if he could develop one with Anthony Robinson. Like, there are lots of possibilities here that are quite interesting when Smith Rowe is playing in the middle, which are not quite the same when you kind of, like, park him out on the left, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I like it. I like it. I would like him to have a good season as well. My player is Gabriel Martinelli. So I would normally have said this was cheating, but I said he was good on Twitter, and I boiled so much piss, I couldn't believe it.
Really?
Like, everyone was raging. People just like, you just like think he can do no wrong. I don't know why you've got like this blind spot for this player, or just like, well, he objectively hasn't kicked on, like, has he? And I was just like, he's 23. He just turned 23. Like, the reason you think he hasn't kicked on is because he was promising when he was 18, and he's now 23.
Yeah.
But like, he's a kid, and players are extremely unreliable normally before 23. Like, if Cole Palmer had like a mediocre season this year, I don't think he will, because he's going to play more as a 10. But like, if you're a winger, it's totally possible that you just have a mediocre season after having a really good season. That's quite common before you're a fully grown peak age player.
Yeah.
And this is, he got 10 goals and assists in 2,000 minutes last season, which is not amazing. There's this quote-unquote stat going around that he has zero goals and assists in his last 14 games for Arsenal. But that's bullshit. Like, there's a guy called Scott Willis who does, like, Arsenal stats on Twitter. And he pointed out that in Martinelli's last 14 games, he's played 6.7 90s, right? So less than half of that. And in that time, he has roughly 0.6 expected goals and assists per 90.
Which is good.
Split pretty evenly between them. So, yeah, you can say he's finished badly in the last 790s that he's played. But if his teammates had scored the chances he'd made in those games, he'd have at least two assists in seven, which is fine. And if he'd scored at XG levels, which actually there's no reason to believe he's a below XG finisher across his career. In fact, he's been a good finisher. Then he'd have four in seven, which is excellent. And more importantly, he's 23. Like, he got 20 goals and assists in the league, 20 non-penalty goals and assists in the league when he was like 21 years old.
Yeah.
He turned 22 at the end of that season. So he was 21 that season. That doesn't happen that often. Cole Palmer got 22 non-penalty goals and assists in the league last year at the same age.
Yeah.
He got 22 at the age of 21. Martinelli got 20 at the age of 21. And everyone thinks Cole Palmer is like absolutely incredible and going to be one of the best players in the world. But Martinelli is apparently not only like not one of the best wings in the league, he's actually shit. That seems to be this belief. And I just think that people need to understand that player development is not linear. Before you're 23, 24, even 25 for some players, you will have up and down years, even when you're fully fit. And Martinelli hasn't been fully fit. He's had lots of injuries. His underlying numbers last season were exactly the same as the year before, 0.6 expected goals and assists per 90. His dribbles went down, but actually everything else went up for him. Chances created went up. Passes into the penalty area went up. Defensive actions went up. Number of shots went up. Even his pass accuracy went up. His ball carrying has gone from good to crazy. Like, the season before last, he was carrying the ball into the penalty area 2.3 times a game. Last season, he went to 3.7. which was fourth in the league. The guys ahead of him for carries into the penalty area last season, who had at least 1,000 minutes, were Mitoma, Grealish, and Doku. That's it.
Yeah.
That's quite exciting. Like, he can reliably beat his man. He's faster than basically everyone in the league. He's a surprising physical problem as well. Like, he's pretty strong. He gets shots. He's more creative than you expect him to be, because like, we kind of think of Saka as an all-round winger and Martinelli as an inside forward. And I do think that is more what Martinelli is. But Martinelli creates an awful lot. And Trossard gets a lot of credit because, one, Trossard is excellent. Two, he is more intelligent than Martinelli, at least at this stage of his career. Like, makes perfect
sense. That's kind of to be expected, age-wise.
It is. And also, Trossard comes on for like, Trossard came on the other day, like, people were like, Martinelli did nothing against Villa, and then Trossard comes on and like scores within like 2 minutes, and you're like, he's fresh, like that's his job. Like, but if Martinelli's fit, he's gonna play a lot. Like, Arteta isn't sold on him the way he's sold on like Saka, but Arteta has always loved Martinelli, and I think it would just be a big year for him. I think he's at the age as well, like Pedro, where you'd expect him to put it together a bit more. The underlying numbers last season, he should have, in inverted commas, had like 13, 14 goal involvements mm-hmm. in 2,000 minutes, which is excellent. And he ended up with 10. Okay, yeah. It's fine. But that's a down season for him. If he just puts up the same numbers again, then he'll probably have a good year. But my suspicion is that if he plays all the time, his numbers will get a bit better. And he should play some more minutes too. I would like to see him get like 2,500 minutes. And that, I think, would be really, really interesting. So I'm quite bullish on Martinelli, and I don't really understand why a load of our Arsenal fans have decided. Yeah. Like, Arsenal fans are desperate for Nico Williams. I love Nico Williams. Nico Williams is great. Nico Williams is much further away from being the finished product than Martinelli is. Like, Nico Williams had a great Euros, but people are acting like he's like the finished article. He is 21 and he is quite raw, and he's a different sort of player. Like, he's much more of a dribbly winger.
He's really high usage.
Like, I don't really, yeah, exactly. Like, everything gets run through him. Mm-hmm. And I don't really want a super dribbly winger on that side. Like, Trossard isn't that, and Martinelli's not that. And I think Arteta wants,
I think,
an inside forward.
Yeah, I think Nico Williams, I love him. And I think I just want him to be in the Premier League. I think it'd be great to watch. But I think after 4 or 5 games of watching Nico Williams kind of run down a corridor and have like 30% success with the dribbles,
yeah,
can get quite taxing quite quickly in a team that wants to retain possession and in a league where possession is so valuable. And not exposing yourself to like quick counters, etc. Yeah, I wasn't aware that Martinelli was dead. This is news. I didn't know Arsenal fans were so down on him.
Arsenal fans, so many Arsenal fans like want him replaced. They don't want like Nico Williams to come in to help out because he can play on both sides. They're literally like, well, the area we should get a centre forward and we should get someone to replace Martinelli, and that's what will make this team better. And you're like, well, if you get like Rafa Leão, then like sure.
Okay.
But if you get like Ademola Lookman, like not really. Like I don't know. I don't really see the argument. But like, look, we'll see. I just think Martinelli has always looked, he always looked until basically last season, as good a prospect as Saka. Mm-hmm. Like, not as all-round a prospect as Saka, not as intelligent a player as Saka, but his numbers were outrageous for his age. To get 20 non-penalty goals and assists in the league, deservedly, at 21, is bananas. And it's just strange to me that, like, he kind of gets written off. And if Arsenal ever sell him, I think he'll have a great career elsewhere. But anyway, that's what I'm bringing back from the dead. So is that the end of it? Is that the end of our predictions?
I think that is. All right.
Well, should we move on to the burn book? All right, burn book time. I'm going to lead with what I'm taking out of the burn book because it took me ages to think of it. But I've realised barbecues.
Yeah.
When you are married or just, you know, living with your partner, deciding what to have to eat is such a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And if you've got guests coming over, deciding what you're going to serve them and all that kind of stuff. And in summer, you've just got a ready-made solution, which is like barbecue. Mm-hmm. Barbecue. Like, you invest in a good barbecue. I remember for years, like, we just had like a little kind of tray barbecue because our garden was really tiny and like, you know. And then we just invested in a barrel barbecue that cooks more evenly, heats up faster. And my wife is like amazing at the barbecue. She cooks mm-hmm. everything to my specification, right, which is the best bit. But she always does like a marinated chicken. She does sausages. She does burgers. She does halloumi. Like, it's everything. The best. She normally makes like a fresh red cabbage slaw or something like that. And this summer, I've just enjoyed it. And I'm really hoping that when we go to Portugal next week, I've got to check we've got facilities. But normally we go somewhere where there are barbecue facilities and we put the kids to bed and Emma cooks a barbecue. And it is the greatest night of your life. Like, once the wasps have gone to sleep and the children have gone to sleep and the barbecue comes out, it's happy days are here again. I like any meal that's predominantly meat and salad.
Yeah, yeah. And also,
to me, that's holiday food.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So holiday food.
I fully support the barbecue. The summer barbecue is great. My biggest issue with it was the cleanup afterwards, you know, for a charcoal barbecue. We had a barrel barbecue that was obviously charcoal, and the rigmarole, the admin you needed to go through, one to get it lit and two to mm-hmm. then clean it up afterwards, is quite substantial. and generally meant that it was off-putting enough for us to not use it as much as we should. However, recently, thanks to some vouchers that we got for John Lewis for our wedding, we upgraded to a gas charcoal hybrid barbecue. So you can put charcoal in it if you so wish, but fundamentally it's three gas burners. And it's, we've only used it once because we literally set it up before we moved to France. But it was great. Like, I went out on a run and Jess just like lit the barbecue. And by the time I was back and showered, the barbecue was like cooked. And then like you didn't need to wait for a heat up. It heated up in like 5 minutes, not even. And then to clean it, you just kind of let it cool, took the trays inside, give them a quick clean in the sink and put them back on. Like it removed all of the worst parts of the barbecue experience and made it far more accessible. So I think we're going forward, now that we have it set up, I think we're going to use it like way more. It's just going to be like a Friday night after work, be like, should we just stick some stuff in the barbecue?
Yeah. There's so much stuff that, like, if you want to cook a steak, like you can cook a really good steak, like on the hob or like reverse sear it or whatever, you know, like that's totally possible. But even if you like to cook your steak that way, if you just like flipped it over a couple of times on a barbecue at the end, it does give it an extra special something. And you can just like chuck veggies on there and stuff. It's the best. Like, it just adds so much to everything. Like, I think that's one of my favorite bits about this time of year. I like how straightforward it is. I don't really mind waiting because we just light it and, like, you know, we might light it, go off and do bath time for the kids, come back and it's ready to cook. So it's not too bad, but
yeah, it was just an extra element of stuff to do that I was like,
sure.
Like, the oven's right there and the stove's right there, you know. This barbecue also has a flat, like, it's got three sections in it. Two are grills and one is like a flat stone.
Okay.
So it's like flat on one side and you flip it over, it's kind of like corrugated. Like a grill pan, essentially. So you could do a steak straight on it normally and then chuck it over under the fire to finish it. You can do prawns on it. You can do everything on it. It's fantastic.
It sounds fantastic.
But yeah, we've only used it once. It's very good. Now we're in France. I think we've had two barbecues the last two nights. And I just love it when it's like, when you look at the table and all it is like a big bowl of salad, maybe some like potatoes or carbs, and then just a big plate of like meat.
Yes.
And bread. And then just bread and butter and maybe some like seafood.
That is holiday food to me.
Like, that's it.
Like, you know, when you would like, you'd come out of the sea like somewhere on a Greek island and there'd be like one taverna on the beach. Mm-hmm. And basically what they serve is like charred meats and like normally chips and then like salad. And I was just like, yeah, that's exactly what you want when you come straight out of the sea. Just like charred meat, salad, maybe some bread or chips. But like, really,
barbecues are so funny as well, because what other meal would you have like four sausages, a chicken thigh and a burger and that'd be like totally normal? Like the volume of meat you eat is quite staggering.
If you were sitting at the table and somebody had like cooked sausages from a pack like in the oven,
yeah,
and they said, "What do you want?" and you were like, "I'll have like three sausages and a burger and some chicken and some halloumi," they'd be like, "You're a fucking like degenerate. Like, what's the matter with you?"
Yeah.
But when you go to a barbecue, it's like, yeah, like have another one. Do you want a bun for that?
Put
some cheese on your burger. Yeah. Like, what's going on? Add some bacon. Yeah. Like, what are you?
What do you mean you didn't want seconds? Yeah.
Yeah. It's the best. And then the next day, there's normally meat left over.
Yeah.
Sick.
Every time you have it for lunch. Yeah.
Okay. That's what I'm taking out. What are you taking out?
Okay. I kind of struggled this week to find something I was taking out. And mine was a bit weird, but I just thought back to the past few weeks and thought, what has brought me joy that hasn't already been taken out of the burn book? Because we're now three seasons in, I'm finding that we've covered a lot of ground in our likes and dislikes. So often I'm finding things that I either like or dislike again, but have already been put in. But what I'm taking out is very specific. What I'm taking out of the burn book is the song My Days from the Notebook musical.
Oh my good God.
Are you a fan of musical Patrick?
Yeah, I don't know.
That sounds like a soft no.
Well, there are some that I'm just like, but people love them, and like it's also becomes like you cannot say a bad word about like Sondheim because people go berserk.
Yeah.
Even though it's just like, we understand that every other artist has good work and bad work.
Yeah.
And then there's stuff that people love that I just think is like I truly don't get it. Like Rent, for example. I despise Rent. I think it's so bad.
It's all right,
But you know, right. I like the musicals. I really like.
Okay, so I listen to music, songs from musicals sometimes when I commute in. Like maybe once every couple of months, I'll just be like, oh, why not? Right. And there are some fantastic. Patrick's just chuckling away at that.
It's just so at odds with your public persona. Like the idea that you're just like sitting there, you're just thinking, look at all these fucking pricks on this train. Yeah. And then you're listening to
Dear Evan Hansen.
Yeah, you're listening to like Defying Gravity yeah. or something.
But like there are some fantastic, fantastic scores out there. Dear Evan Hansen is actually, in my opinion, one of the greatest truly great modern musical scores. But it's quite rare that like a new song comes along and you feel that it's kind of destined for like the pantheon of musical greats, like specifically like solos. Like when you think of the most modern musical, like the most famous popular songs of modern musicals, you think of like Defying Gravity from Wicked, like A Numbers, Not Like Satisfied, or other ones from Hamilton, Suddenly Seymour, Little Shop of Horrors. You think of like
sure.
the really, really famous songs that you kind of imagine every theater kid before like auditioning for anything would pick one of these songs. If mm-hmm. like just to kind of showcase like how what the range like their abilities and stuff. And it's really, really rare that a new song comes along that kind of feels like a challenge them. And this song, My Days, performed by Joy Woods, doesn't sit amongst them now. It's like literally it opened to Broadway this year. But I think it might one day because it's got every component that is needed for a good musical solo song.
Okay.
Like it's emotive. It's got good emotional range. It's like rangy in terms of pitch as well. It starts quite low and gets like really like challenging in the upper register. It's like paced really well. I love that about like certain musical ones that like when they're paced really well in that like they are driving they are at points and then if they slow down or if they go like slightly staccato at points and like playful mm-hmm. and then go more dramatic, like crescendo into this big like finale. It has all of that. It's also got like a really kind of catchy like hook. And it's just a really, really good musical song that is performed incredibly well. And it kind of reminds me of like Idina Menzel's performance of as Elphaba in Wicked's Defying Gravity. Like mm-hmm. that is, if you ask somebody name an iconic song from a musical, I reckon over 50% of people would say Defying Gravity. Like mm-hmm. it would just come straight off the tip of their tongue and their performances feel kind of similar. And the musical itself, it only just opened this year on Broadway, so I haven't seen it. I have no idea if it's good or bad. But I just think it's vanishingly rare that a song from a new musical has this much of an impact on me, like immediately, without even having seen the musical. Like the last song I can think of it that had a similar impact was Waving Through a Window by Dear Evan Hansen, sung by Ben Platt. When I heard that, I was like, fuck, I need to like go and find it, or I need to go and see it. I saw a clip of this song, My Day, sung by Joy Woods on social media. And within like four or five seconds, I was like on Apple Music being like, what is this song? I need to listen to this. And it was incredible. It's like, you should go check it out. It's just a really good performance. It's a really good song. It ticks all the boxes for what I believe to be a very good solo musical performance, like a solo musical song, like a kind of big coming of age song that you have in musicals.
Sure.
And yes, Joy Woods performed well. And I hope the musical's not crap. Because if the musical's crap, then I think that kind of undermines the quality of this song quite a bit. And it will probably never be seen as anything more than like a good song in a shit musical. Whereas if the musical's good, I think it has a good chance to become one of the iconic modern songs mm-hmm. in like the musical repertoire, the pantheon of musical solos.
This is quite a fun, offbeat inclusion.
Yeah, I did say it was niche. And
have you seen the Mean Girls musical?
I haven't. I literally texted Olivia the other day because we're waiting for her to move back to London. Mm-hmm. And I said, when you move back, us three should go and see the Mean Girls musical in a weeknight, mm-hmm. one night. Because yeah. it just feels right.
I think that would be right. I watched the film of it.
I watched the film. I was at the premiere of the film, Patrick.
What did you think of the film?
The media premiere film. It was fine. It was fun. It was okay.
One star.
I thought it was fun. I thought it was
fucking
fun. You hate it?
Hated it. It was so bad. I just think it was like, it just didn't have it was stuck in this weird space where they kind of wanted to add new material, but they also kind of were like trying to get all the juice from the old jokes. But like, I was like, I can see why this exists on stage. It's a different experience.
Yeah.
But like putting it on film, I was like, this looks cheap. and I'm just watching the same people do literally exactly the same jokes in some situations, but like 20 years later and worse. And I was just like, I was truly bamboozled watching it. I was like, this film shouldn't exist. The same way that I watched the Matilda, the musical film. And like, look, people say the musical is great. I haven't seen it. I haven't been to the theater in like a year, in many years because of my children. But I was watching that the film of it, and I was like, this film fucking sucks. It's so bad. It just shouldn't be a film.
I think my feedback to people when they asked me was a Mean Girls movie good or not, I was like, it's not going to win any awards. It's a bit of fun if you know what you're getting in for. Like, if you know you're getting in for like this kind of pantomime version of Mean Girls, it's fine. It's enjoyable. Like, it's a bit cheesy and it's very nostalgic. So if you like Mean Girls and you're not expecting like an Oscar award winning performance or anything that's like, it's also not really music. I don't know the songs in that. I think there's some different ones in the actual musical, but the songs that were in that, there wasn't really anything that was like quintessentially musical song. I think there was one at the end that was kind of slightly musical. I'd Rather Be Me, that one, is the closest one to a genuine musical song. The other ones weren't really musical songs. But it is what it is. Like, it's kind of what I expected. I never expected it to be good, but I want to watch it because I'm like, yeah, it's a bit of fun.
It just feels
cheap
like
fun.
But a musical is like, the idea of a musical, right, is that the emotion is so heightened that people burst into song, unless it's a sung through musical, in which case you're just like pure suspension of disbelief. But like, there is a structure for that that makes sense. And when you try and like squeeze an existing property onto like the kind of musical structure, you have to be careful about how you do it. And I feel like quite often people are not. Like, there's this idea that you can just chuck some songs into a film that works without them and that it will now be a functional musical, which doesn't really make sense to me. Like, it's just like, I mean, I guess that I grew up like you did with the kind of the like Ashman Menken school of like musical making, where it's the idea of like, here's the This Is Our World song and here is the I Want song, and you know, like you have this like very classic sort of hero's journey to it that is established through these songs. But it always just feels a bit cynical. That's just like, there are loads of elements of the film that don't work. Like, Regina George is really bad. The jokes kind of aren't funny because you've seen them before, or the new jokes just aren't very good. And they also don't really have the balls to commit to it because they're like, we don't want to. There's loads of stuff from the film that, because it's 20 years ago, it's a bit outdated. Like, they don't want Regina George like saying like, you're a lesbian to everyone, like all the time. Because it's like, then she's kind of impossible to redeem at this point. So there's like this kind of shit that they really struggle with. It just seems like a fundamentally misguided enterprise to me. But anyway, I watched it and like, I think Emma gave it like 3 stars and I was like,
I think I might
have given it 1.5.
I think it's fine for what it is. I think 3 stars is accurate.
Nah, shit. putting in the Burn Book this week. What am I putting in? There was one I was going to put in, but I think it's a bit too long.
Okay.
So I'm going to do an easy one. Do you find that you meet a lot of adults who say stuff like, I don't like vegetables, or I just don't really eat vegetables?
Yeah.
Grow up. what the fuck do you mean you don't eat vegetables? You're an adult. Like, I don't understand this. I didn't really know that was an option. Like, it was not an option in my house when I was a kid. Sure. And I'm not saying you should, like, force your children to eat these things. But if you put it in front of them and give them the option to eat it enough times, they will start eating it and they will start liking it. I'm always stunned when I meet somebody who's like, you know, they kind of roll their eyes and they say it like, oh, I know it's a bit silly, but like, I just don't really like eating vegetables. And I'm just like, you're not a real person. Like, that's, I don't take that seriously. You know, the same things I've taught before here about like, adults I know saying they don't like water, and it's just like, I get that you would rather drink something else, but when you say like, I don't like the taste of water, I was like, water's taste is neutral. Like, it kind of has no taste except being cold and refreshing, which is good. But people don't like vegetables. I just think how are you alive? This is just bad. Like, this is bad for you. It's stupid. And also, vegetables are not like a homogenous group of foods that all taste the same. I'm sure you like potatoes.
Yeah.
Do you like parsnips? Do you like carrots? Like, it's quite easy to enjoy vegetables because there are almost infinite varieties that you can find.
I'm not a big vegetable person, but I have vegetables that I like.
Exactly.
There was these carrots at the wedding I was at the weekend, and they were amazing. Like, the carrots were so good. But I will eat vegetables until there is, unless they're staggeringly good, I'll eat vegetables until there's nothing left in the plate. If all the other stuff is gone and there are some vegetables remaining, I'll probably just leave those vegetables.
Okay.
I prefer them as an accompaniment, but I still eat vegetables. Like broccoli slaps in
sure, but there are
forms.
People... But there are people who would like, say you were going to like a tapas place and there were like padrón peppers or something.
Yeah,
there are
class.
People who'd be like, well, I'm not going to get that because those aren't, because I'm not into vegetables. And it's like, that's fucking stupid. Like, do you not like parsnips roasted in honey because they're incredible? Yeah, do you not like roast broccoli when it goes a little bit charred and you cover it with like
some oil, maybe like almonds as well? Like fried almonds.
Or sesame seeds or like chili flakes, like anything like that. There are so many good vegetables. I love vegetables. I don't feel good if I don't eat them for a while. I don't understand how what's going on with people who are just... It's just strange to me that there are some people who are like, I reject this thing and I'm an adult. Like, how do you respect yourself as an adult when you don't eat vegetables?
How much of this do you think is down to like what they've been exposed to, though? Because say... what they refer to as vegetables are like chopped up carrots that are boiled and soggy with no flavor. Like that is not a good version of a carrot. I can understand them developing into an adult that's like, no, I don't eat any vegetables.
But what a point.
But they're
a
good version of everything.
And at what point are you responsible for your own education? Like if somebody said to you, I hate musicals, and you were like, well, what musicals have you seen? And they're like, I haven't seen a musical, but I've heard The Music of the Night from like Phantom of the Opera. And I've heard, what's that song? I Don't Know How to Love Him from Jesus Christ Superstar. And I thought those songs were shit. Then you'd be like, well, okay, but your problem is exposure. Like, go and listen to some others and find some that you like. Like you're allowed to not like musicals and you're allowed to not like those songs. But if you're going to, like, give such a blanket statement, I kind of expect you to know a little bit more than just to say, like, well, these are shit, but I don't really know the first thing about them. It's like, you don't get an opinion if you don't really know anything about it. And also... vegetables are not like musicals in the sense that they are good for you and you actually need to eat them. Like, you need all sorts of... you need roughage, you need micronutrients. Like, there are loads and loads of things that you need to get out of vegetables that are hard to get even from supplements. But if you don't take supplements, certainly from just, like, you know, carbs and protein. Like, there's this idea that these are the fun foods and these are the foods that aren't fun. And you don't need to eat every vegetable. But when you're an adult, you should have found some vegetables by now that you like. And you should eat them regularly. And certainly saying, oh, I don't really eat vegetables. Like, if somebody comes to your house and, like, you serve them food and they're like, don't want to take some salad or they don't want to take some vegetables, I honestly look at them and I'm like, you're a fucking infant. Like, get a grip. You're an adult person. Like, once you're in your 30s, I'm sorry, but do some shit that you don't initially like that might be good for you. Because that's the other thing. All the research we have on this suggests that somewhere between 9 and 13 times is how many times it takes for you to start enjoying a new thing, you know? And sometimes you don't want to do it. Like, I've basically resigned myself at this point to being like, I just don't think I'm an oyster guy. I just don't think I'm an oyster guy.
Oysters.
Like, yeah, they're just not for me. Like, that's fine. Yeah. I don't have an issue with it. It doesn't mean that I don't try them. Like, every now and then, because I don't try oysters very often, when they come along, I'm like, I will try one again just to see if I've changed my mind. Like, yeah. And maybe at some point I will, like, but I don't have to, that's fine. But you do need to give something a few goes, I think, before you're just like, well, I just don't eat that. And it's always amazing to me, the people who just kind of can't be asked and who therefore have like a really shit, weird diet. But more importantly, a little bit of discomfort is actually good for you. Don't be a fucking baby.
It's called growth.
Yeah, exactly. It's called growth. Never heard of it. Right. Are we done here?
No, I think I still need to put something in.
Yeah, I thought you did.
Yeah, yeah. So what I'm putting in the burn book this week is power slap. Now,
sorry, what?
That's quite a difficult word for me to say from Northern Ireland. So P-O-W-E-R, power slap.
Power slap.
Yeah. Do you know what this is? First off,
no.
Okay, so this is a true representation of idiocy. Basically, what it is. And I've only ever seen it on social media, but basically what it is a it's like this new combat sport. And two people stand. Two people stand on opposite sides of a small table, similar to like arm wrestlers, and they then proceed to just take turns slapping each other in the face with the intention of knocking the other out. I have no idea to what end. I have no idea if is there rounds? If nobody's knocked out, do they just keep going? I have no idea the structure of the sport. But honestly, it is the most idiotic thing I've seen in a while. Like, it truly is natural selection in motion. I don't mind violent sports like boxing, MMA, etc. They're all fine. Like, I'm not a big fan of them, but I don't object to them. So it's not about like the violence. It's more about the lack of skill and like the idiotic level of trauma they're causing. Because even with like arm wrestling, which I think is also pretty dumb, there is an element of tactics to it, because you're like physically engaged with an opponent. And, you know, there's an element of tactic where you might try and, like, you have to alter your approach to like your opponent's strengths or weaknesses, because you're physically locked to them. It's happening in real time. This is just like bookended. I slap you, then you slap me, and then we continue until somebody's knocked out. Mm. Like, there surely is no form of tactic in this, because the opponent's not even allowed to move.
Yeah, there's no variable.
Yeah, like you're hitting a still object as hard as you can, and it just happens to be that still object happens to be the face of an incredibly stupid person on the other side. Mm. And you see, like, after one or two slaps, the side of their face is getting slapped is like bright red and really swollen, like instantly swollen, almost going purple. There's like blood coming out their mouth because I imagine the inside of their gums are torn to shreds. And I just can't get my head around how this is a thing and how people are like, yeah, this seems like something I'm interested in trying. I think if we tabled this, if we took this to like the earliest societies, like the most primitive of societies, and said, here's a game we're going to play, we're going to stand and we're just going to slap each other in the face until one of us falls, I even reckon like the most primitive of civilizations would question the validity or the reasoning behind this. Mm-hmm. I reckon like cavemen would be like, this seems a bit stupid.
They'd be like, shouldn't you at least like fight properly?
Shouldn't like it be about strength and skill, not just about like,
because otherwise they might as well not slap each other, they might as well just slap a thing that registers who's got the strongest slap.
Like the punch bag thing.
Yeah, and then it's like, you've got the strongest slap, you win, well done.
Outside of even the trauma caused in their face, the brain damage that this will be causing over time will be staggering, because even with like boxing and that, one, they have like pads in their gloves, like 8-ounce gloves, or what professional boxers use, and they're also like actively trying to evade them. And knockouts, while fairly common, I suppose, in boxing, the frequency at which these slap fighters or whatever are knocked down and kind of like almost semi-unconscious, like there's a guy standing around them behind them to catch them, because they get floored so frequently. So they're pretty much coming back up semi-conscious. So they're essentially kind of getting knocked out multiple times per like bout. And the lasting effect of like brain damage and that will surely be huge. Now, I imagine that the people involved in the sport are not society's most valuable minds, but still, like there is still a concern that these people are competing in this sport where, in an era where we're stopping children heading footballs because of like concerns of brain trauma, there are more concerns about like brain trauma in rugby. Like, I'm pretty sure like a collective, there was a class action lawsuit brought against some rugby union professional like governance body over head trauma in rugby, like ex-rugby athletes, ex-rugby professionals. People are really concerned about like boxers becoming punch drunk, and you can certainly see in a number of ex-boxers when they like do punditry, you're like, fucking hell, this is like, you're like walking, your speech is like you're walking in treacle. It's like, this is concerning. And it's just so weird. I don't know, it's not a sport, there's no skill to it. It is just gross idiocy in action.
Yeah, I don't really get it. Like, at least in boxing as well, like the rewards on offer are enormous, whereas you're like the winner of like Power Slap, like that person's not getting like $10 million, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, Dana White now backs it. I think Dana White owns part of it, who's the president of MMA, and I think he was quoted saying that it's going to be bigger than MMA. That sounds just like it's PR spin
bullshit. There's no way.
But yeah,
it's not a fun spectator sport.
No.
It's fun as a spectator sport, like the first time you see someone get knocked out, and then you're like, right, I'm done with that now.
But
that's
also
crazy.
You can watch one round, or even extend that to one fight or bout, whatever. Once you've seen that, you've seen everything.
Yeah,
at
exactly.
least like boxing is different. There's different types of different styles. MMA is different. There's like grapplers, there's strikers. There's lots of different variables in it. Once you've seen one of these, then you've seen them all.
You could make that argument about darts though. As in like in darts, two people are technically playing separate games side by side. Mm. Like your game doesn't affect the guy next to you's game. And people do enjoy watching that, but that's had a culture that's grown up around it over yeah. like 60 years. It's been a pub game in this country forever. And also it's never gone beyond this country. And also no one gets injured.
Yeah. But also I think
there's an ironic element as well.
Part of the, like, there's very few people who are like, oh my God, this guy's like, the technique is unbelievable in darts, or like, he's just so sure. incredible. Everyone's there being like, when they hit the right section of the board, we cheer.
We go, fuck your mentor, and we like yeah. drink. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. yeah. It's an event. Yeah, sure. Okay. I think this is a good one. Like, I just don't understand. There's so much stuff like this where you think, yeah, I like in 20 years time, I just think you'll be like, why the fuck did I do that? Like, I gave myself brain damage.
Yeah.
For like a little bit of like clout online, I guess. Yeah, like, so it's insane. That brings us to the end of our public episode for this week. We'll catch a bunch of you over on the paid side where we've got our ABF bumper mailbag special. Thank you very much for your support. Thank you for your reviews. Thank you for continuing to listen. Please continue to spread the word. If you don't subscribe, consider doing so, because we do make an effort to bring like good normally football content on the paid side. And you can obviously ask us questions as the season goes on. I think it's going to be a particularly interesting one. I guess we'll catch you later. Is that how I end this? See you guys later. Bye.